Hi everyone, a very quick hello from me today as tomorrow I fly out to South by Southwest EDU. Congratulations to Rocket Fund and Edspace who launched their 1 mile project this week in the UK. This week we've also had the UK digital strategy and you can check out the impact on education and edtech with most details in the appendix and circulating around accredited services, data integration and broadband. This week's podcast is sponsored by Full Fabric, with a message to all the higher education listeners out there. If you work in university admissions and you're considering ways to streamline your marketing and onboarding processes, check them out. Full Fabric is developed by a team who worked within a university and were frustrated by the experience of supporting students effectively. They realised any software solution needed to be customisable to help universities recruit, market to and admit students in one place. All data is hosted on the cloud, meaning it can be accessed anytime, anywhere and on a range of devices. If that sounds of interest to you, you can request a free consultation about your university's admissions process by visiting learn.fullfabric.com/podcast. And if you'd like to support the EdTech podcast mission to improve the dialogue between Ed and Tech by partnering with us as a long-term sponsor, please contact the edtechpodcast@gmail.com. This week is the second of a three-part series on EdTech trends from BET. This week we've got ICT Connect 21 and the Japanese Association for the Promotion of Educational Technology on the incoming coding curriculum. The Bloodhound Project on STEM, primary students from Islington, London on digital leadership, mobile gaming company Wibu on gaming for language learning, and finally BET Award winners Digi Exam on changing the assessment process in higher education. Don't forget to also check out the EdTech Podcast Extra with award-winning musician and tech enthusiast Imogen Heap. The last of the three-part series on EdTech trends at BET will be out next week with Bisa, Nace, Tinker and an extra from digital leadership guru Eric Scheninger. Fantastic. So we're at Crowlands Primary School in Havering and I was very excited when I drove down here this morning because I knew that I would be able to meet a group of Japanese EdTech and education innovation enthusiasts who are visiting this week. And so I've been lucky enough on a busy schedule to get some time with Yoshimi Ishizaka, who works with ICT Connect 21 on the Technical Standardization Working Group based in Tokyo. And Yoshimi, welcome, first of all.
Thank you.
And you were explaining the makeup of this group, so what it's about and that kind of thing.
Okay. In Japan, there's some industry groups and the NPOs, various kinds of organization. But in the past, each organization work independently.
Yes.
So ICT Connect 21 was established about 2 years ago.
Okay.
To connect them, not only on private side, but also public side, including the government offices, the board of educations.
Interesting.
That's a concept of our organization. So the network of networks to support the transforming education with ICT.
And prior to that, you were working at Microsoft.
Yes.
Yeah.
I worked for Microsoft.
Yes.
And I'm now working independently and supporting the organization.
So my questions really, so was for the listeners. So we have listeners from all around the world, but say the primary base is UK, US, Australia, Ireland, is to give them a little insight into what the education and edtech landscape is like in Japan. So for example, you know, if we think about schools and school makeup, are those mostly private or state? Are decisions made locally or centrally? And what's the current status of how technology is used?
Okay, in my understanding, in comparison with the other countries, Japanese education system is relatively centralized.
Okay, yeah.
Controlled by the government, the Ministry of Education. So they set standard curriculums.
Yeah.
And they uploop textbooks subject by subject. So in terms of curriculum, Japanese education system, especially in K-12 area, it's so standardized.
Got you.
Yeah, but education is done not only at formal schools. That means after school education activity is so active.
Yes, and you also have, is it Juku?
Juku, yes, you know, yeah, you know, yeah, yes, yeah. Yes, yes.
So cramming schools.
Cram school.
Yeah.
Not only physical classroom, but also online school services.
Tutoring.
Yeah, yeah.
And is it correct, I'm not sure if this has happened yet or is happening, that you will also be adopting a compulsory computing curriculum, so learning coding and that kind of thing?
So, national standard curriculum is revised every 10 years. Mm-hmm. And the next timing is 2020. And for primary school, the concept of the next revision is the active learning. Mm-hmm. And for primary school, two topics are major. One is the English learning class, mm-hmm. and another is the programming.
Okay, yeah.
So the starting programming class will be so tough.
Because it's a new, completely new topic. And
yes. So we came to England to learn your experiences.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it has got easier because now it's a couple of years and yeah. And so were you also at BET this week?
Yes.
Yeah.
And last week, yes.
Last week, yeah. Oh, yeah, it's already gone a week ago. And then, I mean, what role do you think technology currently has within, you know, an average Japanese school?
You know, in Japan society, technology is so
like pervasive.
Popular. Yeah. Everyone has his or her own device.
Yeah.
Devices. Yeah, smartphone, something. So, however, at school education, in my understanding, the technology is not fully utilized yet, because of various obstacles, including budget, and security concern, personal data protection law, such matters make teachers concerned to fully utilize technology.
Okay, and then in terms, I mean, lots of UK edtech startups are starting to think, where can we go outside of the UK? And in terms of the edtech that is used, is it mostly domestic edtech, or are you seeing edtech come in from other countries, come into Japan?
No. So, the, for example, Khan Academy video, some of them are translated into Japanese.
Okay.
However, in the general people in education mindset, the exported materials out of their scope.
Yeah, out of their scope. Yeah, it doesn't quite translate.
Yeah. The concept is different or something.
I understand. You, having just experienced the UK version of a tea ceremony, it's different.
Yeah.
So, and then in terms of edtech in Japan, which things are you seeing are sort of having a bit of traction? So, for example, is it robotics or is it saving time in schools? Or which are the particular sectors within edtech that are making...
Actually, recently, many edtech venture companies started. as I told you before, in Japan, the private area after school market, it's so big.
Yeah.
So it's easier for edtech companies to go into that area rather than
formal.
Yeah, formal school.
Interesting.
Market.
Yeah.
So B2C.
Yes.
Market rather than B2 school.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Maybe something similar is happening here as well, I think. Mm-hmm. And are there particular events in Japan that people should know about if they're listening and they're interested in education technology? Are there particular events that happen in Japan that you think, yeah, you should go to that one?
The programming is one of the hot topic. And so another issue is the Japanese teachers are so busy, actually too busy. They are working more than 10 hours per day.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there is summer vacation season, but usually teachers cannot afford to try something new.
I understand. And then also, does that mean that EdTech, which helps with teacher workload, is useful?
If some technology can reduce mm-hmm. their burden and shorten their working time, mm-hmm. that's very great.
And are there events? So, for example, are there trade shows like BET in Japan?
Yes, there are at least two or three. New Education Expo is held every year, sponsored by Uchida Yoko. In June in Tokyo and Osaka, Sapporo, follow.
And which companies and organizations do you have on the Japanese delegation here?
At this time, 17 people came to UK, including technology companies like the NEC and Panasonic and the textbook publisher. And learning material providers like Gakken.
And
those
also
people.
Some people on the academic side as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's your network that you mentioned here.
Yeah.
Awesome. And then how can people find out more about ICT Connect or what you're doing or connect with any of the delegation? Are you on Twitter or should they contact you personally? I see you've got a Facebook group. So it's facebook.com/ICT Connect 21.
Yeah. Okay. You can communicate.
Amazing. Thank you very much for your
time. Thank you very much.
Yes. Oh, all right. I thought she wanted me to sing.
Yeah, it's actually karaoke.
Is it?
Yeah.
Any particular song?
I'm a fan of Tainted Love on karaoke, but I just sing the and that's it.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's not massively creative, is it?
Well, it depends how you
Mark
look at it.
Mark Arman, Tainted Love. That's kind of my era, isn't it, really? It's kind of very 80s.
Maybe that's why I chose it.
Yeah.
Here we go. Woo! So, what are we watching here?
What are we watching? We are watching kids getting inspired and engaged by rocket cars. What is not to get excited about? Watching your own car that you've constructed and designed and built race down a track at a staggering acceleration rate faster than a Bugatti Veyron. What's not to get excited?
So how fast are they going?
They're actually travelling from the position at start, which is rest, to about 6 meters, and they're getting to 25, 26 miles an hour. This is just a test track. When we run cars as part of our competition, that's free and available to all schools in the UK, they'll be knocking on speeds of 55 miles an hour.
And will those be similar cars or slightly bigger?
Very similar, same raw material, and of course the same brain power of engineers, young engineers, which of course is people that use technology to solve problems, as we all do on planet Earth from the day we're born.
And these cars here, so what we're looking at is, it looks like polystyrene, plastic wheels, microbit in the middle.
It's got a microbit in it, yes. We use a microbit with a battery attached to it to gather data. So that's no different than if it was a wolf in Alaska. Do wolves go in Alaska or Canada? Or, of course, monitoring babies in hospitals. Or Formula One car trackside. It's telemetry, distant measuring. There we go. Yo! Another car goes whizzing down the track.
So what's the smell?
It's sulfurous, yeah. Because we're actually using explosives.
Excellent. I love explosives.
So exciting, isn't it? So it's the context. What are we doing? We're actually using the project of Bloodhound, building 1,000 miles an hour car. A real engineering project to inspire and engage young people to take up science, technology, engineering and maths.
And Rob Bennett, that's your name?
That's my name.
And what do you do?
My job at Bloodhound is chief inspirer.
Okay, and what's your background?
My background is varied. So I started out life 30 years ago in a band.
Okay, what band? It wasn't Tainted Love,
was it? No, it wasn't Tainted Love, no. So I started out life in a band in the 80s. And we used to go into prisons, youth custody centres, really? Young offenders institutes,
that's
using music in social education. We used to do big gigs as well. I then did some real jobs, working in retail, working in training, working in health and safety, and I've ended up working for Bloodhound.
Amazing. And so your role with this, though, is the inspiration in terms of linking schools and others.
Absolutely.
With what you're doing?
Yes, that's exactly right. So this is nothing if we don't engage and involve young people. Young people are employees. Well, they will be one day, of companies. So what is education for? I think that's a really good question. So I'll answer it. In my view,
I'm just going to go and sit down whilst you do
it. Education is for inspiring and engaging young people into lifelong learning and equipping them for the world of work. Mm-hmm. How do we do that? Well, we need to encourage and inspire them by giving them real projects to do real things, to contextualize stuff like maths and physics, because it's life, not subjects, and they need it all the time. So if we can equip them with stuff in their toolbox to do stuff like design and build rocket cars, or find a solution to the problems like energy, feeding the world, etc., etc., then I think we've done a really good thing.
And do you think, I mean, you mentioned STEM and STEAM, this focus on maths, for example. Do you think it's actually about learning how to do maths, all that computational thinking and problem solving that you mentioned? Because some argue that, you know, maths will just be outsourced to AI. We won't need to do the actual nuts and bolts of it.
That's twaddle. Yeah. Nonsense. We do maths all the time. Mm-hmm. How am I, the most complicated computer in the world, going to solve problems? I need, sometimes, equations. Mm-hmm. I still need someone to interpret that data who has experience, who can look at the subtle changes, as our driver will, Andy Green, who will be in the Bloodhound car going 1,000 miles an hour in the desert. We have seven of which he is one.
And so, for those who know the Bloodhound project, so, as you mentioned, essentially building what will be the world's fastest land-based car, is that correct?
Land speed record car.
I've seen your old base out in Bristol.
Yes.
Are you from the West Country area?
I am. I am from the land of the free and brave.
Yes.
Cornwall. Cwm Ystwyth Ficon. So I grew up just outside Truro.
Okay, lovely.
And we have got a fully functioning operation of engagement in Truro.
Yes.
Working with Cornwall Council. And of course, the only place in the United Kingdom where you will be able to see this car run is in Newquay.
Amazing. And when is it going to happen?
End of this year.
Oh, really? Okay.
And that soon.
How many years, the culmination of that project is how many years?
Nearly 10.
Wow, amazing.
Long time.
So there's a lot of excitement, I would imagine, that's going to actually
Huge amount of excitement and engagement. We've got in racefortheline.com 120 Cornish schools engaged in designing and building rocket cars, which of course where it all began in the 1820s. With that amazing engineer Richard Trevithick harnessing the power of steam to make the world's first horseless carriage.
Amazing. I love this. I've learned a lot about old engineers. Every day's a school day. And for your actual launch of this project, is it going to work, by the way?
Is it going to work? The person in the car, Andy Green, Wing Commander Andy Green, of course, a fully functional member of the Royal Air Force, is designing and being involved in every part of that engineering process. He knows it will work.
Yeah.
But, of course, we are like the Starship Enterprise, boldly going where no man has gone before, beyond 780 miles an hour is a mystery. Everything is theoretical, but we will prove the science and we will do it safely. This is about building a fast car safely.
What do you think about people like Graham Obrey?
Interesting.
Yeah. Okay. And what will the launch look like? We have lots of schools there. What's the kind of big activity?
Yeah, so we've got activity, as I say, the UK, runway testing, shakedown tests like you would do pre-season Formula One. Okay. We're just going to fire up the EJ200, the world's most efficient jet engine. Produces 9 tons of thrust, weighs 1 ton, and just pop it down the runway at about 250 miles an hour.
In terms of how that will look, will you have all the... Is it going to be similar to when a rocket takes off and you have all of that combustion?
So if you watched a Eurofighter Typhoon, which, as you know, Sophie, has two... EJ200 jet engines.
Well, I did know that, yeah.
So that's 18 tons of thrust. That's not enough to get one man to go 1 mile at 1,000 miles an hour on the ground, mind. Then you will know that it's going to create a massive amount of sound and flame and heat and light, and it's going to be really cool. Well, very hot.
And what about inviting our international friends to come and witness this phenomenon?
Absolutely. So we will, as soon as we've got some dates in the diary, we will be publicising that globally. And we will make sure that anybody and everybody across the globe, because, of course, what are we communicating? We're communicating in the language of science and maths, which is universal, will be invited and are available to come along. Obviously, there are limited numbers. And then we will take the car out to South Africa and go for the land speed record, which was set 20 years ago by the driver who's going to drive Bloodhound.
Okay, so he must be very excited as well.
Oh, he couldn't be more excited.
Can I ask a question? Will there be a chance for a female driver to have a pop?
Well, who knows? Unfortunately, like Formula One cars, the car is built around Andy. So we've used the latest technologies, composite manufacturing and additive manufacturing, to design and build a cockpit that fits Andy Green.
Yeah. Might be a bit of a might be a bit roomy then.
It would be a bit roomy. He's about 6.5 foot.
Yes. Okay, and then if people want to find out more, do you have a Twitter handle?
Yep, so they can just go to bloodhound_EDU or bloodhound_SSC or #bloodhoundSSC.
Amazing. Thank you very much, Rob.
Thank you, Sophie.
Yay! I am in my favourite type of company, which is lots of lovely young people, lots of smiles, and creative banners, and I'm just trying to find out a little bit more about what these digital leaders are thinking of the companies and the innovations that they've seen at BET today. So who wants to be brave and go first?
My name's Franklin.
So how old are you, Franklin?
I'm 11 years old.
And from which school?
Newton Green Primary School.
So we're here at BET, so what is it that you've seen around the show that's excited you?
Well, as we've walked around, I've seen VR headsets, I've seen people with like different robots which are coded by like apps we use every day. And like there was one where it was like a robot, but they used Scratch and it was doing like dancing and all that.
And do you use Scratch at school?
Yeah, we do a lot of Scratch.
And what's your favourite subject?
What, in school?
Yeah, or out of school?
My favourite subject has to be art.
Oh, brilliant. And what would you like to be when you're older? The old question.
I want to be a firefighter.
Oh, brilliant. It's always useful. So in terms of today, have you think you're going to award
judge.
The best stand or judge? So can you give us a little sneak preview of what you think's been best?
I can't remember its name, but there was these group of people and they had a map. And you jump around and it asks you a question like, what chemical or like scientific chemical? And the kids were jumping about, stepping on the letters. But you weren't allowed to step in the fire, so you had to jump around and spell the letters.
And what was it about that you liked?
You kind of think a lot, like, I need to get there, but how do I do it? And then you need to think, oh, what word could it be? How do I spell it and all that?
Brilliant. So thank you very much and enjoy the rest of the day.
Okay.
We've got another interviewee here. So what's your name?
Matthew.
Oh, brilliant. My brother's called Matthew, so it's a good name. And which school are you from?
Newton Green Primary School.
And is that the best school?
I don't know.
You don't know. Fair enough. What have you enjoyed at the BET today?
I enjoyed the robot one, but he tried to steal a bit of my popcorn.
What?
I whacked it off my hand.
No, not allowed. But you've kept the popcorn in the end.
Yeah, but I don't want to eat it anymore.
When you're in school, what do you like? What gets you engaged?
ICT.
Oh, really? Okay, what's it about that then?
That you learn what to do on a computer and how to use it.
Within your school, do you use a tablet, a device, or do you use a phone? Or?
And some people go around and take pictures sometimes.
Okay.
Of people who are doing really good work.
Interesting. I'll speak to the little lady here. So you've got a badge, digital leader. So what does that mean?
My name's Noor. Digital leader is responsible for like technology and what you do like in ICT. And they're one of like the good people how to like control like the computer and do stuff.
And so do you help teach the other children how to go about that?
Bit.
A little bit, yeah. And I mean, as a digital leader, what would you like to see more of?
I would like to see more of like trying to explain like how to use the computer properly.
Okay, and do you enjoy learning how to work that all out as
yeah.
well?
Yeah.
Lot.
So what's your name?
My name is Jackson.
Okay, and how old are you?
11.
And which school are you from?
Alexandra Palace Secondary School.
Okay, brilliant. And have you been to BET before?
Yeah, this is my second year here.
Okay, so you're a pro. What is it about, you know, what you've seen? What do you like? What's caught your eye?
I like the robotics. I want to bring, like, some of the stands, some of the ideas from the stalls back to my school to, like, help with ICT.
Interesting. And if you had to help in ICT, what would you like to change or improve?
Well, I'd like to do a bit more coding.
And if you were to solve a problem in the world with coding, what would you choose?
Maybe a robot. I don't... something like you could code a robot, I don't know.
And what would the robot do?
It could help you with your homework or something like that.
That sounds brilliant. I think all the children like that one. Yeah, excellent. So we'll move along. So what's your name?
My name's Lily.
And which school do you go to, Lily?
I go to Newington Green Primary School.
Okay, and how old are you, Lily?
I'm 9 years old.
And what's this list all about then?
It's about what my favourite stalls have been. And personally, I think the 3D printer stall was the best stall so far because it's just about how long they've taken out of their own time to make these things and how they make it.
You'd know way more about 3D printers than I would. And then you've got Minecraft. What else do you have
Glam
there?
Sky.
What was Glam Sky or Glam Ski?
It's about science and it's where you can... learn about the insides of your body.
Okay, so is that like a VR, AR thing so you can see inside? I guess the idea of that is if you're in a biology lesson, you start to learn about parts of the body. So.
Yeah, yes. I really liked Code Club because they're teaching you about coding like in clubs after school and it's just taking your own time to think about coding to learn more about it.
I'm here with Dean Jacob, CEO of Wibu. And Dean, you're in the Department for International Trade area of the show as a British... Are you a startup still?
Yeah, I suppose we would still class ourselves as a startup. Yeah.
And so Wibu, so I'm basically looking at a sort of adventure game type iconography behind you. You're a mobile game, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
So could you tell me a little bit about you, how you got into this, what Wibu is and what you're doing at BET?
Sure. So Wibu... is a team of about 15 people. We're a group of game developers and linguists and language teachers who have come together to essentially modernize the way that the world learns languages. My personal background is I've always been totally in love with languages. I studied 8 languages at university, worked for the government as a linguist for 4 years, taught Spanish and English privately for just over a decade, and then founded Wibu 3 years ago with 3 very good friends of mine, and the team has since expanded, and this is our first full-length game, Ruby Ray, that we're bringing out in March this year.
Okay, very interesting. And how did you go about doing that? So when did you start having that conversation, and how did you get to this point? Are your friends on the sort of developer side of things?
Yeah, exactly. So we all brought different skills to the table. Myself, I had the language background. My friend Liam, his background was in software development, and then 2 Spanish friends of ours as well had backgrounds in marketing and PR and design. So we were sort of the perfect little team to get started.
Just thinking about languages and, you know, how massive that is as a potential sort of sector to go into, I suppose, or educational problem to solve. Obviously, on the market, some of the most probably visible things like Duolingo, Busuu, that kind of thing, Memrise. How do you differ from their approach?
Well, yeah, you mentioned some of the big apps out there, and you know, there's some really great products out on the markets at the moment. What we're looking to do is to take a slightly different approach to language learning. Our philosophy and ethos of the company is about long-term engagement with language learning. As you or anyone listening would know who's tried to learn a language or has learned a language, whether it's when they were a kid or more recently as an adult, it's really tough to learn a language, and it takes a very long time to do so. And the most important thing is your motivation to learn. If you don't have the motivation to learn, and particularly that intrinsic motivation to learn, the pure enjoyment in the process of learning, then you're not going to stick with it for long enough. So our aim as a company, and the thing that I think we do very differently to anyone else, is that we just try and provide a really enjoyable and immersive experience that doesn't feel like you're having the chore of learning and that you know, the burden of something educational and pressurized.
And so what age group is this aimed at as well?
So from a design perspective, we've built it for teenagers and people in their 20s or 30s, but we've actually seen, particularly here at BET, we've seen lots of younger kids as well, 8, 9, 10-year-olds that have come and just been completely glued to the game at the table. So I think it's something as well, it's the same with film, that you know, 12-year-olds want to go and get an 18 certificate at the cinema, and you know, our content is all very, you know, family friendly and just as appealing to kids of younger ages as well.
And so can you talk me through a little bit the content? So who's the main character? What kind of obstacles do they have to overcome? And how does that aid the language learning as a result?
Sure. So the lead character of the game is a girl called Ruby Ray, which
got
is the
hair.
Red hair, which is the title of the game itself. She is a space explorer, so she goes around the universe and analyzing planets with Molly, which is her spaceship. She unfortunately crash lands on an alien planet and is separated from Molly. And the Ruby's mission and the mission of the player is to find Molly and find her way home. So along the way, we have a great storyline. We have really compelling characters. We've brought on board an incredible scriptwriter. We've got a great art director, and we've got a BAFTA-nominated sound director working on this to really bring the experience alive. And through it, players build up a very strong emotional connection with the story, with the characters, which in itself is a very important element to learning a language and to be able to retain language, having some sort of psychological connection and emotional connection to what you're learning.
And so I can see here, so you know, you've got the language piece at the top. Actual people playing this, do they have to use that to solve, do they solve problems through the language?
Exactly. So it's whether it's problems to do with the storyline, knowing which characters you need to speak to, what exactly you need to do on the particular level, you by understanding the conversations that you have with other characters in the game, it helps you know what you need to do throughout the game. And there's also lots of little mini games as well where you have to do, you know, enjoyable things that might be, you know, against the clock sort of little mini games and things as well to keep things fun.
And as part of the DIT area, what have you got from them? I mean, it's interesting. I was moderating a panel yesterday, and it was looking at STEAM, so arts within this big focus on science and maths and so on. And the lady there from Imperial College, doctor there, her point was, you know, we have these amazing industries. So out of the UK, you've got an amazing gaming industry. But perhaps students aren't that well aware of that being the case and therefore going into those industries. So I just wondered, you know, from the DIT's perspective, are they quite excited about gaming and, you know, making that more visible?
They are. DIT have been amazing at supporting us as a startup since we started 3 years ago. We were actually accepted onto a program they run called the Sirius program, which is for teams that are split with British founders as well and non-British founders. And through that, we got financial support from DIT. They put us in touch with mentors. We were put onto a startup accelerator programs to help build the company. And even today, 3 years on, they're still supporting us financially with things like the stand here at the BET trade show. And they do similar things with other trade shows around the world. They continue to support us in all of our markets globally. So we're very active in Latin America, and all of the representatives from DIT across Latin America have done a lot for us. And actually, you mentioned video gaming. Last year, DIT actually opened up a video gaming department itself, so they actually have an advisor working specifically in gaming. So it's really great to see the government supporting these sorts of initiatives.
And what's the business model? So, you know, are you revenue generating already, or?
So Ruby Ray, that's coming out in March, will be our first monetized product. Previously, we had a concept game out last year, in 2015, which was free. We had over 250,000 downloads. We went to number one in the App Store education category in 20 countries around the world. And it proved that there was a high demand for this type of product. So this coming March, Ruby Ray will go onto the Apple App Store and Google Play Store for £2.99, the cost of a cup of coffee. You get a high-quality, full-length video game, which we hope will be loved by everyone that downloads it.
And what about in-app purchases? Will you have that as well? So
no, so one of the reasons why we've gone for the premium model and charged up front is we don't want there to be any hidden costs later on. It's really important from a learning perspective that you know, the way that the game is written, the script is written, there's a complete learning experience from start to finish. So we want to make sure that it's paid up front and that's it, and you get the full game for that price.
And how about schools? Would they have to purchase this individually, or are you looking to also do something for schools, or?
We're open to different options with schools. Yeah. We've been approached by a few schools or school groups or distributors, and they each favour different models depending on what they're doing in their region. Some are, you know, shared revenue models, some are licensing models for just this one particular school.
How about partnering with publishers as well? So I'm just thinking, you know, some of the publishers out there still working out what edtech means for them, whether they, you know, just especially those that have a focus on language learning.
Exactly. Well, I think it's something really exciting for publishers because I don't think they've seen something that's so gamified, which almost masks, in a way, the education element for the end user. I think when publishers are usually approached by edtech companies or go out to seek them themselves, there's always an element of the game that is so obviously educational that it perhaps puts off particularly young people because they just want to play a game. So that's really important for us, and it's an important element for us that we hope would also be attractive for game publishers as well.
And if people are listening in, or if there's you know, language teachers listening in, how can they follow what you're doing and get in contact?
Well, they're welcome to email us at info@wibu.com. They can check out our website, www.wibu.com. Yep. We're very active on Twitter, @wibu_studios. Instagram, the same, @wibu_studios. Feel free to drop us a line. We're very happy to speak to anyone and everyone connected to education and gaming.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
So I'm here with Melissa Phillips from the BAFTA Young Game Designers Awards.
Okay, so I am the program producer at BAFTA for the Young Games Designers Competition. This is a competition for 10 to 18 year olds to get them interested in video game design. So what we have two categories that are divided by age. So there's the 10 to 14 years and then the 15 to 18 years. And then we have two strands within the competition itself. That's the game making and the game concept. So the game making category, they are for the coders. They send us at least one playable level of a game prototype. And the game concept, they don't need any coding experience at all. They just have to have a really awesome game idea. So we get some really amazing ideas there. Some include technology that like doesn't even exist.
Okay.
They've come up. They can go wherever they want with a game concept idea. What we do is we have this competition. We then showcase it. We have an award ceremony. We have industry executives that come in and act as part of the jury. And then we support them all the way through. So our first ever young games designer is Dan Pierce. And he was one of our Breakthrough Brits. He went on to be a BAFTA Breakthrough Brit, and he was even nominated for a BAFTA award. So he's done incredibly well. He was our first ever young game designer back in, I think it was 8 years ago now.
So how old is he about, just to get an idea of how old he is?
So 8 years ago he would be 18, so,
yeah,
19.
Okay,
yeah, he'd be in his 20s now.
Yeah.
So he's sort of one of our success stories. Our first ever female has just started her first year at university to study game design. So we're really proud of what they're achieving.
On that front, do you know some of the best universities or the universities that are leading on a course like that, if students are interested and want to know how to get into it?
Absolutely. I think, you know, the education side, the universities are starting to take notice now and make game design courses that are specific for the industry. We work very closely with Abertay University. So the Abertay University actually take the winning games from the Young Games designers and turn it into a functional prototype. They use their students as a sort of learning curve, you know, to be given a design brief, and then they have to create that design. So they use that as part of their learning tool for their students. And they've been fantastic at supporting Young Games designers. But I mean, there are brand new games design courses opening up all over the country. I know Falmouth recently has opened a games design course.
What type of teacher do you find helps the children apply for this? So are they from a particular department?
This is really interesting. Yeah. Really interesting. So because we have two game strands, we have the game concept and the game making. So the game making is all for the ICT teachers, computer science, code clubs, after school clubs, things like that. So we get that very specific, more technical side of teacher that are interested in game making. But the game concept is starting to attract people like English teachers, arts teachers. We also have a lot of business management, like, you know, anyone's doing business studies. Yeah. We get those teachers that are interested in it as well, because they love the idea that they can go to their class and say, oh yeah, video games are cool and great to play, but did you know it can be a career? There's
and
an industry.
A huge, like, multi-million, billion-pound industry, yeah. Interesting.
So one of the things that have changed this year is that we have redone all of our teacher resources. So we've come up with a series of lesson plans and downloadable worksheets and a 6-part web series that accompanies all of these. These are all available to download for free on our website. That's ygd.bafta.org. The lesson plans include things like session activities that can be done as groups. We also do homework activities, so if they wanted to set something before they came to the lesson, they can download worksheets that can be given out for classrooms as well.
So those are all free?
All free.
Is it free to enter the awards?
Absolutely free to enter.
What's the educational problem that you're trying to solve, which is my question I'm asking everyone here?
There are a number of things I think that we need to focus on in games design and games as the industry in general. One of the things is getting more girls into games. That's been there's been huge changes made, positive changes. You know, we're seeing a lot more women enter the tech community in general. Young Games Designers itself, we have, I think, 32% female entries, which is well above the female games. I think it's 18% at the moment in the games industry.
But we were talking about this before. Like, I think the biggest consumer of games is sort of middle-aged women, if I'm correct.
Yeah.
On some.
I don't know I don't know the stats exactly.
Yeah, but I think, you know, females consume huge amounts of games, but yet there's still a skew in terms of actually creating
definitely.
Them. But it sounds like, you know, that percentage isn't as awful as some of the statistics we hear sometimes.
And I mean, there are amazing, inspiring women now working in the games industry, and I think they are doing fantastic work in order. You know, I'm a big believer in the sort of see it, be it idea. That it's no good sort of going into schools and going, you know, come on girls, be games designers. It just doesn't, it turns them off from
it.
Yeah,
like it's a burden, like there's only 8%, therefore it's, you know, we need you kind of thing.
Yeah, it becomes more aggressive. And I think it's a more positive way of doing this is to show them a woman in games doing everything that all the men can do as well. And I think that's something that we are able to do. We're very lucky at BAFTA that we have access to some of the top industry talent. And then this includes, you know, some really powerful and inspirational women. I'm Jessica Curry from The Chinese Room. We've got Rihanna Pratchett. Just amazing women. There's Gina Jackson now at the Imaginarium. These are all women that are doing a
keep
fantastic.
Coming, so I don't know all these names, so it's really interesting.
I love it. Women in games, there's so many out there, and I think we just have to give them a platform.
I mean, do you have a perspective on what educational games you rate? So there are obviously, I think you've got different types of content. You've got educational content, which is trying to gamify its content, but still kind of learning content per se. And then you've got games coming up. So just thinking about things like Lightners, Big Bang, and Wibu, where they have specifically gone out to say, this is gaming first, and there's educational outcomes in there, but that's not how you get to children, because they just want to play the games and then, you know.
Perhaps. I mean, that's kind of exactly how Minecraft all began, isn't it? It wasn't ever intended to be an educational game, and yet children loved it. And now, only now, are we sort of starting to realise, oh, we can use this in a different way. One of our YGD mentors from 2 years ago now was Ray Chambers, and he uses Minecraft within his school lessons to actually teach them. He's got his own website. He's got his own. It does lots of resources for teachers in order to how you can use Minecraft in a classroom environment. He was also responsible for the literature regarding the micro bit. So he's a sort of using it within the classroom in an educational setting. But you know, kids will also play it however they want. They'll build a house.
It depends on at what point of the journey where creativity has sort of been beaten out of you. Yeah. You've got to, but sometimes the freedom to do absolutely everything, kind of almost, it's like analysis paralysis. Like people don't, it freaks them out. So actually having some parameters to work from.
Teachers have a hard job. You know, they've got a classroom of 20, 30 children, and if they want to enter the Young Games Designers, that's maybe 20, 30 ideas that they have to come up with. So we're trying to show you that you don't necessarily need a fully fledged idea, you just need the spark of an idea to get something going. With the YGD in the past, we've had games that come through and they'd make brilliant films, they'd make brilliant books and trilogies, and you know, they've fleshed out the characters sort of for generations, but there's no gameplay.
Yeah, it's like a Hardy novel or something. Yes. Like that. Okay, cool. And then we've got one of your colleagues here from Nintendo, is that right?
Yes, we have two of our BAFTA crew members here today. They're part of our BAFTA Crew Games program, which is for those just starting out in the industry. And they normally have about 2 to 4 years experience in the games industry, and we bring them in for networking, and they get to do masterclass events and live streams. And we have Benjamin Maltz-Jones here, who has just landed a job in Nintendo. And we also have Kai McGilligan Oliver, who is, let me get this right, you're a game designer at Deckbound. Yes.
And can I have a quick chat with
Absolutely,
these guys?
Please. Yeah.
Okay, so it's Kai, isn't it?
Yep.
So time's moved on since, I'm guessing, when you're at school and sort of getting into gaming and then also thinking about that as actually a career to go into. Do you think it's got easier for kids to think about that, or do you think it's still pretty far to go?
I absolutely think it's so much easier to be exposed to the idea of games and even stuff like creating your own YouTube channel, being present digitally, either as a creator or a consumer, is definitely like really present in the minds of young people these days.
Yeah.
And it wasn't so much when I was younger. So interestingly, I did a physics degree. Now that put me in a good place for making some aspects of video games, like the coding bits and the mathematical bits. But I know a lot of my friends and colleagues who they've done history degrees or English or art, and they all play into the roles of making games. Like their skills that can be brought to the industry. And I think I really value that. So even though you now find schools with courses for video games, and even at GCSE level, you know, you have these skills being built up. It's fascinating, because I think we're going to start seeing new types of games being made because of those courses, but I still think it's really important that schools maintain this concept of you can take your degree wherever you want to take it.
Yeah.
I found video games eventually. I've loved them all my life, so I'm really lucky that way.
And do you think that the idea of going to university to become a game designer will just become obsolete? Do you think, I mean, I'm just thinking 3 years, you know, by the end of that, hasn't technology moved on anyway? And so you could do a more modular approach to some of these skills, or do you think?
I think that the big key part of that is that the making of games is democratized. So the tools are now all free.
Yeah.
You can, rather than having to code, or having a knowledge of code, you can make games without that much knowledge of code. You can be an artist and make it. So I think actually the use of tools is a really big part of that. So whether going to university is valuable for someone or not is of course a very personal decision, but yeah. I think you're going to see a lot more people, like in the indie game scene, the scene that I belong to, as well as working for a company, I access that, and I know that lots of people haven't done degrees and they've found their way into the industry in a more maybe natural way.
So, I'm guessing some part of that natural way is just actually connecting with like-minded people and networking, and you know, networks is a horrific word sometimes in these contexts, but essentially that's what it is, connecting with other people and, you know, following your passion in that way. If there are students or teachers of students listening and you think there are meetup groups or other things that could help inspire them or guide them, where would you recommend that either they go to online or in person to do that?
Oh, that's a really good question. I've recently joined a makerspace,
okay,
which is a physical, it's more a place where, you know, you make objects with woodwork and metal, but there's also electronics and engineering and software as part of all that. And that makerspace based in South London is really, really amazing for me now, because I realised what I didn't have, which was those meetup groups.
Yeah.
So I can only imagine for kids these days, that ability to meet up and sit and talk and converse over ideas and just try things out there and then with your friends. That's invaluable, and I'm so glad I found something akin to it when I'm older.
And what's the makerspace called? If people want
so that's to... actually called South London Makerspace.
Okay.
So you can definitely go check that place
Ronsil
out.
Name, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, brilliant. I think that's really helpful. And yeah, you said sort of the indie scene. So yeah, are you on Twitter? Do you connect with people? Is there like a Twitter chat or anything like that?
Yeah. If anyone wants to contact me personally, they can go through at Cradius, which is spelt like a crayfish. And then IUS, so okay. Cradius. Yeah, we do.
And what's your favourite game?
Oh, that question. I was brought up on stuff like Sonic and stuff like that, but Final Fantasy VII is the one that I tell when Sony are listening anyway. Okay. Yeah.
And who's your favourite designer?
Ooh. I must admit, in terms of like games that have been designed by a company, I can definitely say that Media Molecule are one of my favorite design companies at the moment. They just do such fun and amazing work. But individually, Ralph Costa, always, he's at the top for theory at least. Like, okay. He's one of my favorite.
Very interesting. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brilliant. So I'm here with a BET Awards winner. So could you introduce yourself and say what award you won last night?
So I'm Gustav Nordbeck and COO of DigiExam. And we were lucky enough to win the BET Award for Higher Education, Further Education, Digital Services, which was a fantastic honor for us among such a established and innovative roster of other names in EdTech. So yeah, super exciting.
And what in a nutshell is DigiExam, and also what educational problem do you solve?
So we are a digital assessment platform reaching out, catering for teachers and professors, so both K through 12 as well as higher education. And very simply, we solve two main problems. On the educator side, we solve the problem of marking, the amount of time wastage in marking is huge, and just making the whole exam delivery, exam creation and marking process smooth, quick, seamless, but also collaborative. And as part of that, data reliability and security is a huge issue, and that's something that we is really at the core of our platform, so that we can ensure that you can deliver an exam without internet, with internet, but with no risk of losing data.
This is very interesting, and I am familiar with your product because I was one of the actual BET judges. So my question is, we're bringing in EdTech and innovation into classroom. Once you get to the exam room, quite often that goes out the window and students are back to pen and paper and doing exams in that way, which could then almost feel quite alien to them. How much of this is actually being used in terms of final exams, and how much is sort of run up and...
So that's a great question, and we were actually conceived in a high-stakes higher education environment, Stockholm School of Economics, and it was initially optimizing for that high-stakes exam situation, the final exams, and what happened was it actually got kind of picked up and started being used in more of a formative assessment. So today it's used from anything from just a quiz on a weekly basis in a classroom in a secondary school. But then also the kind of standardized national exams in Sweden, the equivalent of the A-levels or the GCSEs. So this year we delivered about 11% of all equivalent A-levels in Sweden. So very high stakes situations.
Obviously in Sweden it's kind of taking off. I know then you've gone to the US and things are going quite well for you out there. How have you found the uptake or the questions here in the UK? And I'm just thinking about utilising in terms of our A-levels and taking that leap. And I'm guessing that you have the option, you know, if you want to do the exam, I know you can do it offline, because then people freak out about whether, oh, plagiarism or so. I'm just wondering what kind of questions you get asked when you're talking to educators here this week.
So I think, you know, there are a fair amount of questions around the whole, you know, the exam boards, do they allow for the digital submissions and so forth? So we haven't started working with the exam boards in the UK just yet. We have clients that have done the GCSEs, but what they then tend to do in the UK is they actually, the exam gets delivered through DigiExam, but then actually it's printed out and submitted through paper form to the exam board, because they haven't allowed for the full digital process yet. But to be honest, that was the same experience, and you know, in Sweden in the beginning as well, because you know, there was it's not gone 100% digital in Sweden either. So you get a lot of questions around, you know, the high stakes and whether or not we are kind of integrated and the exam boards actually allow for it. So yeah.
Interesting. And so how did you get into all of this? Did you co-founded the?
So I'm not a co-founder. Okay. I joined a year ago.
Okay.
And I used to work at a language learning company called Rosetta Stone.
Okay.
So I set up the European market and also Brazil for Rosetta Stone. And then I just developed a big passion for education and the actual need to transform parts of education, not all, but and that's how I got in touch with the two co-founders, and I really love the vision. So yeah.
And so what universities or schools do you have on board that, you know, others who are listening will recognize, and just in terms of some of your client base?
Yeah, so very exciting. We're working with Cass Business School in the UK. We just started in 2016. We're doing the a pilot for Cambridge, the University of Cambridge, they're testing across a couple departments, which is also super exciting. We have a bunch of other you know, higher educational institutions in the UK, in the US. We also work with institutions like Georgetown, Columbia, etc. So yeah, a few of the names.
So I mean, I think you're in a sweet spot at the moment, whilst these organizations are kind of transitioning and the student teacher ratio is changing, and we're not quite at the, you know, where it's going to evolve to. So this feels like quite a nice sweet spot in terms of a step change to that. What other functionalities does it have? I'm just thinking about peer-to-peer marking, things like that, and that's another approach to alleviating some of the stress load in terms of marking. Have you considered that, or is that part of your existing offering?
Peer-to-peer marking we haven't incorporated, but what we do is basically teachers or professors can then share with other colleagues. So, you know, it might be that they share a third of the questions with someone else who can mark them. Absolutely. So, but it's not kind of peer-to-peer amongst the student base. But for now, it's about collaboration on the educator side.
Okay. And then I don't know if you've had a chance through your conversations or from walking around to pick up on any other trends that are happening that you think are relevant in terms of EdTech and where it's going, or education and how it's innovating. So just wondered what your thoughts were.
You know, I think we've seen a lot of movement to bring your own device. We've seen movement in the kind of the OER movement, which is very exciting space. I think in the space we are, when it comes to assessment, it's also, you know, with the whole kind of online and the development of the online courses, online degree courses, you know, authentication and proctoring is a very interesting topic. If you look at the incredible potential that higher education has in terms of delivering online courses, a key point is to be comfortable that the person who is submitting an assignment or the exam is actually the right person.
For you, yeah.
So you need to have a way which is scalable to authenticate, you know, technology enabled, be it biometric or behavioral, but then also, you know, down to proctoring, so that you don't have to sit and have someone who's watching the person who's writing the exam. So that's a big space which is evolving as well.
That's really interesting. So a lot of these problems that are coming up are based around scale, and you know, you exactly that. So, you know, can you afford to have that one person sat next to that other one person taking an exam?
Yeah.
As all of these classes explode and so on. If people want to follow up more with what you're doing, are you going to open an office here, or what's the plan for the UK?
Yes, so we're just starting to build a team locally in the UK.
Yeah.
So absolutely, and you know, if you want to follow us, I mean, digiexam.com, you can sign up.
Thank you so much, Gustav.
Thank you very much, Sophie.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you've got comments on anything from where you enjoyed listening to something you wanted to get off your chest, record a short voicemail for free at speakpipe.com/theedtechpodcast. I'll be tweeting from South by Southwest EDU this week. Whatever you're up to, have a good week and hopefully meet or see you soon.